Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org. Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you're always in the know about important issues. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club and our moderator for today. We are delighted to have with us for a conversation today the Honorable Nancy Pelosi, Democratic leader of the U.S. House of Representatives, our wonderful representative in Washington from the city of San Francisco. Today we are celebrating with Leader Pelosi her 25 years in Congress, a journey that began with her victory in a special election in early June of 1987, following the untimely death of her friend, Saula Burton. The celebration over the weekend of the 75th anniversary of the Golden Gate Bridge was a reminder of how much Leader Pelosi has done to improve life here in the Bay Area. Marking her success in preserving the Presidio and the parklands around the bridge, it was fitting that Middle Drive East in Golden Gate Park was last week renamed Nancy Pelosi Drive. And of course, she has achieved a great deal for the nation as a whole. One need only recall the passage after a difficult and fractious struggle of legislation embodying the first comprehensive improvements in the nation's health care system in decades. 2 years ago, that was a fight that Leader Pelosi led to its successful conclusion. And her championship for HIV/AIDS research and treatment has benefited people not only in the Bay Area, but in the nation and in the world at large, where this is a significant problem. You are all familiar with Leader Pelosi's personal history and background. Daughter of Baltimore's leading political family, mother of five, volunteer in San Francisco civic affairs and politics, and then for a quarter century, San Francisco's representative in Congress, the first woman to serve as House Democratic leader, the first woman selected as Speaker of the House, and then Democratic leader again. Serving in Congress for 25 years and doing it well with increasing influence and effective outcomes requires some special qualities. You have to know how the political institutions and public policy system works and how to do this very complex job. You have to know how to work well with other people, both inside the Congress and outside, in a way that brings them along to recognize the importance of your views and your goals so that they join you to support your positions. You have to recognize good ideas, problems that can be addressed, and strategies that can be used to address them. You have to be able to listen to constituents and others in the political process, including those with opposing perspectives. You have to be patient and persistent. You have to be focused. You have to be energetic. The commute between the West Coast and Washington, not to mention the nonstop activities in Washington, is grueling. You have to engender the love and support of your family that allows you the time and space to do this extremely demanding job. You must have clear ideas of what you want to accomplish and what groups, individuals, and actions are needed to make these objectives into realities. You have to be able to stand firmly with your party and to reach across the aisle when needed. This is a very demanding set of talents. Nancy Pelosi has all of these qualities, a unique mixture that has made her so successful in Congress and successful representing the people of San Francisco. She is the most effective and high-ranking person from the Bay Area ever to serve in Congress. Ever, period. She is the model for an effective leader within the American political system in our time. And she pursues her work with a modesty and focus on the issues and the goals that is extraordinary in our era of ego-driven politics. You won't find her name on many buildings or other sites. The naming of the street in Golden Gate Park in her honor is a very unusual occurrence for a Congresswoman Pelosi. What I especially notice about Nancy is that she has a vision of how the U.S. political system should work at its best, without extremism, without ethical compromise, able to accomplish big important goals in the service of the people and the national interest. It is this vision she pursues, and she holds firm to it and thereby makes it into a reality. We celebrate her today for her skills, her accomplishments, and for being a standard bearer for the best of the American political system. So we congratulate and welcome the nation's Democratic leader and outstanding Congresswoman from San Francisco for the past century, Nancy Pelosi.
Thank you.
Could you start by recalling for us that time, 25 years ago, when Sala Burton was ill and the question arose of who should run for her seat in the House? How did it unfold that you were asked and accepted to run for the congressional seat from San Francisco?
Thank you, Gloria, for the question. You can introduce me any time. I don't know whether we're going to put that introduction up for a vote for approval or not, but I was looking around the room as you were speaking, looking for my children and my granddaughter to make sure that they heard some of that as well, as well as so many friends here and new friends in the at the Commonwealth Club. Oh, there they come. There's some right there. You missed the introduction.
We'll hand deliver a copy to them.
In any event, I'm so honored to be here. The Commonwealth Club, just the name, the sound of it means excellence. It means understanding. It means respect for all views. It means the highest level of people in the world, leadership coming here. It means local officials being in touch. And it means that they have tremendous leadership in the president and CEO, Gloria Duffy. I first met Gloria, I'm going to tell this story first, in the middle 80s, before I was in Congress, we went to Central America on a fact-finding trip during the Central American Wars. It was a very difficult time. Father Prevett is here from USF, and when he was sworn in at his inauguration, he had a commemoration of the Jesuits who were killed there and the housekeeper and her daughter as part of his ceremony. So it just shows you how tied this area was to what was going on there. The most informed person on the trip was Gloria Duffy, someone the rest of us really had not known until that trip. She was an expert on Soviet weaponry and the rest, and so she brought a trained professional eye to the fact-finding we went down there to see. One of the questions that we had when we were coming out of there is, where are the Contras getting all this hardware? Where it was, she, of course, with her informed perspective, guided our look. I mean, we were looking into schools. We were looking at all kinds of things. But how this war was being conducted was really something that was her expertise, and we benefited from it. And at the time, we couldn't figure. You know, we were in El Salvador. We saw what was working, what wasn't in terms of helicopters and the rest. And in Nicaragua, we couldn't figure out where were the Contras getting all this firepower. It would be later that we would learn about Iran-Contra, but Gloria Duffy spotted the puzzle right then and there, just an example of the wisdom, knowledge, and perspective that she brings to anything she addresses. That's why it's an honor for me to be here with her, in addition to her role as president and CEO of the Commonwealth Club. Well, it was a long time ago, over 25 years ago, and a Congresswoman, Sala Burton, was our Congresswoman from San Francisco. She had followed in the footsteps of her husband, a great congressman, a champion for this area. Probably nobody in modern history has done as much for the environment than Philip Burton, and much of the work that we all celebrate really started when he was a member of Congress. In any event, Sala called me and she said, I know that people want you to run for mayor. Well, not really, but, you know, people say that. You should run for mayor, right? Oh, okay. Not that I took seriously, but you shouldn't do that Now, mind you, I had no interest in running for political office whatsoever. I grew up in a political family. When I was born, my father was a member of Congress from Maryland. When I was in first grade, he became mayor. When I went away to college, he was still the mayor of Baltimore. And it was only then that I went to college that I realized what normal people did on the weekends. They didn't walk precincts and stand on street corners and give out leaflets every weekend. So I thought, well, I'll go for the normal life. It was never even thought. I'm an Italian-American young woman those many years ago, that we were to be protected, not to be to put ourselves out there. So and it never was. But my brother later became the mayor of Baltimore. He was the one that was groomed, if you want to say that, but was interested in that. So anyway, I had one thing or another been a volunteer. I was on the library commission. And the one thing and another drifted back into being a volunteer in politics, became the chair of the California Democratic Party, which was a big honor for me, the biggest party in the nation, and I was the chair, imagine that. And then Sala said, I'm thinking that I won't run again. I want you to run for Congress. And Sala, I had never even thought of this. You know, I had five children. Now four of them are in college. One, Alexandra, who was going to be a senior in high school. But no, they were old enough that I could think about something like this, but I really never had. And so she said, well, I'm not going to run again, and I want you to promise me that you will run in my place. And I was reluctant. I went home, talked to my daughter, who would be a senior in high school, of course, to my husband, who said whatever, you know, one way or another, whatever you want to do. Paul's very supportive. So I went home. Alexandra, at the time, was just ending junior year. She was going to be going into senior year the following year. And I said, Alexandra, you know, with all the sincerity, with all the that I could muster, this really doesn't matter. One way or another, I'm happy with my life, but Sala wants me to run, and so I have a chance to run. It doesn't mean you win. It just means you run. It's up to the electorate whether you're going to win. So I'm happy to stay here with you, but I'll only be gone like three nights a week for a certain number of weeks if I were to go to Congress. Thinking this was really heartfelt and heavy duty and all of that. And Alexandra looked at me and she said, Mother, which was unusual, no longer Mom, Mommy, Mother, get a life. So I did. I mean, another life. But I had never heard that expression. Now, this is over 25 years ago. I had never heard that expression, but it got right to the point. And then, in any event, it was a difficult campaign because many people, they knew I had no interest in running, and all of a sudden now I'm a factor in the race. I had the support of many people in our community. We built a grassroots operation that was successful, and one thing and another, John Burton, Sala's brother-in-law, was the chairman of my campaign. One important thing happened, though, between her asking me to run, shall we say, in the following year, was that in with a few weeks, Sala passed away. So the election was upon us right then and there. And that was very sad because many of us had lost a dear, dear friend, a champion for social justice and so many things important to our community. And now I had promised her I would run, so I had to win. I mean, a woman asking a woman to run, this is not, you know, this has not been the path where many women have come to Congress because there just haven't been that many women. When I got there, there were about not two dozen women out of four. Say this whole room, two rows of women, all the rest men. Well, maybe there weren't this many people in Congress, but 435, about 20, 24 women at the time. So it was, and when I got there, I went to the floor. This was, my colleague said to me, don't say a word. When you're ready to take the oath, there's special election, so it's by yourself. Just raise your right hand and say, yes, you know, I do solemnly swear. That's all you have to say. Don't say another word. I think I've told some of you this before. So when the speaker, then Jim Wright, said, would the gentle lady from California, our newest member of Congress, like to address the House. Who turns that down, right? I have constituents I have to represent. So I looked, and my colleagues were like, be short, be very brief, be very brief, be very brief. Nobody wants, yeah, be very brief. So I was very brief. I thanked my parents who were there. My father could be on the floor of the House because he was a former member of Congress, and that was pretty thrilling. And my family thanked, first, most importantly, my constituents. This all took less time than I'm telling you right now. And I said, well, after thanking and acknowledging, I said, I told my constituents that when I came here, I would tell you that Saleh sent me, and I'm here to fight against HIV and AIDS. Boom. That was the end of my statement. Is that short? So it was over. I saw these same people, and I said, how'd they do? I was short, right? And I said, why on earth would you have ever mentioned HIV AIDS? This is the first thing these people are finding out about you, and you want them to think that your priority is HIV AIDS? Why did you say that? I said, for the simple reason of that it is. That it is. So it was a different time in terms of people recognizing what the challenge was. But we in San Francisco had multiple funerals in a day, really. Mark, you know this. Mark, Bishop Andrus is here. We're so honored. It was before you came here, but you know that in all of the churches, and even people who weren't believers were having their ceremonies in churches at that time, and there was no way I wasn't going to tell them that was a priority as part of the larger issue of healthcare, which was the major issue in the campaign at that time. But I'm sure you'll ask about healthcare in another question.
So I was going to ask you about your greatest concerns at the time you were elected, which you've really answered. What else was on your agenda? As you thought about going to Congress and serving in Congress, what motivated you to do that? What did you want to change or accomplish?
Well, when you were reading some of the things that had happened in the 25 years, I was thinking that we did it together. None of this happens alone, and you don't want to use the editorial, the papal, the imperial we, but we really got this done together. Because, as I've said to you and I said earlier to some friends, many honors can be bestowed upon you, including being the first woman Speaker of the House, but nothing compares to every single day for 25 years walking on the floor of the House representing the people of San Francisco and California. This is a place that is a hotbed of values, of whether it's equality, whether it's social and economic justice, whether it's protecting God's precious gift to us, our planet and the environment. Whatever it is, it happens here in a very important, well thought out, but passionate way. As I say, passionate, but dispassionate about how we get the job done. So what I thought I would do when I was elected was to, and I was doing it as I was campaigning too, is just to take a look at the map and see every place we could create a job, every square inch, whether it was affordable housing, whether it was transportation, you name the issue, health issues and the rest. How can we create jobs here, turn ideas into economic opportunity for families? And then a couple of, one natural disaster, the earthquake, the other, base closure fell right into our laps. I mean, we didn't want them, but they came, and they gave us an opportunity to put together the public sector with the private sector, nonprofit sector, to make the change here, whether it was the Presidio, the Hunters Point we're still working on, a Treasure Island, the opportunities that were afforded there, and of course, with the earthquake, the decision to take down the freeway and do what we needed to do as we were addressing the immediate emergency needs of the people. So we were able to bring really billions of dollars into San Francisco for all of that. But also the idea, you know, we talk about the infrastructure, but the infrastructure of ideas. For example, San Francisco has to be one of the most expensive housing markets in the country. Would you all agree? And we are all living here, so somehow or other we've managed it, but it is difficult for us to have a cross-section of low-income families and the rest living here. So the ideas of low-income housing tax credits and initiatives like that, which were on fire here, had to be translated into legislation there or sustained, if it was already there, to be sustained. Whether it was HIV/AIDS, where we talked about community-based care, prevention, and research. All of the things that were happening here were not important ideas, not only to our area, but they became national models of national significance. And so when we wrote the bills, we had the ideas of that were modeled and successful here. So therefore, when you write the bill that way, the criteria helps when you're competing for the funds, because it looks a lot like what you were doing in the first place. And that's called leadership in terms of our community. So it was about jobs, it was about social and economic justice, about protecting our environment. Of course, the HIV/AIDS issue had many aspects. It had health care and it had discrimination. And again, the models here formed the basis for the Ryan White Care Act eventually, the housing opportunities for people with HIV and AIDS. You know, it took the form of, and I'll go into more of them if you wish, but the health care was the most frequently asked question when I was campaigning. What are you going to do about health care? Do you believe that it is a right, not a privilege? And I did. And at the time, Senator Kennedy was leading the way with his a formulation of what it would look like legislatively. We here wanted single payer, then later that would evolve into some form of a public option, but long ago it was more an employer-based agenda that would make it affordable, accessible, higher quality, lower cost for all Americans, and that is really, when we passed that bill, it was the culmination of what we had as a priority such a long time ago here in our nation. And I'll talk more about health care if you ask me.
Well, let's do that. Okay. In fact, you've laid out issues which still have relevance 25 years later, and I want to look at some of those going forward, like jobs in the economy that we've most recently been concerned about. But let's take the health care legislation. To dive right into the crux of this, the Supreme Court has taken under review the Health Care Reform Act. How do you think they're going to result? How will that result? And where do you think we are going? What has been the impact of the legislation in the 2 years since it was passed? Just comment generally about this issue.
Well, the Health Care Reform Bill, in our view, is right up there as a pillar of economic and health security for all Americans. Social security in the 30s, Medicare and Medicaid in the 60s, and now health care as a right, not a privilege, and a path to that affordability, better care, a lower price. And let me just lay this foundation. If there were no other reason to do health care reform, if everybody loved their situation, we would still have to do it because the present system, the system that was present a couple of years ago, and we're still working our way out of, was unsustainable financially. It was unsustainable to individuals, to families, to businesses, to local and state and national government. The budgets just cannot withstand the cost, the rising cost of health care, and it's unsustainable to an economy because it's a competitiveness issue. Other countries don't really, that we compete with, don't really have healthcare is an issue because they have healthcare as a right in their countries. So it was very essential that what we did would reduce the deficit and reduce the cost of healthcare, take us on a curve that was going down. Of course, the quality of care, the disparities in our community, that 30 million or more people did not have healthcare, was a driving moral urgency. And Senator Kennedy said it so beautifully, the great unfinished business of our society, that we do not have health care as a right, not a privilege. The Supreme Court is now, we believe in judicial review. We believe in the constitutionality of whatever we pass in Congress. So we believe that this bill constitutionally is ironclad. It is not we did not win the public relations battle on it, but from the constitutionality, it is ironclad. I predict a 6-3 verdict from the Supreme Court, but I really don't know. I mean, only those within that inner sanctum know what is going on there then. But in terms of its constitutionality, ironclad. The forces that we were up against were the health insurance industry and another component, which was anti-government ideology, which is no government role in any of this. Surprisingly, some of the same people were saying no public role were also saying keep your hands off my Medicare. But but anyway, so the arguments that were made against it about abortion, no public funding of abortion, not a real issue. Death panels, not in the bill. That it's going to increase the deficit, no, its purpose and its plan is to reduce the deficit. Job killer, no, it creates 4 million jobs. So people were saying things just because they wanted to be negative, but not because they were basing it on fact. The facts are that over 80 million people have already benefited from the bill, whether it's kids who can stay on their parents, young people who can stay on their parents' policy until they're 26 years old, whether you're a child with a pre-existing medical condition already, you cannot be discriminated against on the basis of a pre-existing medical condition. Millions of people benefiting from the preventive care free annual checkup in that regard, the list goes on. And what I like very much is that no longer will being a woman be a pre-existing medical condition. Just because you've had children or could possibly have children doesn't mean that you should be discriminated against. But the list goes on, whether it's shrinking the donut hole for those of you who are my age. Shrinking the donut hole means lowering the cost of prescription drugs. So it has benefited tens of millions of people already. It has not won the public relations battle that is to come. But there's a lot to lose that is already in effect, even before we go into 2014 when it is fully implemented. But this is about life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. It's what our founders intended, a healthier life, to pursue your happiness, to have the liberty to pursue your happiness. Imagine if you wanted to be a photographer, a musician, an artist, if you wanted to start your own business, if you want to change jobs, you have the freedom to do this and not be job locked because you have a pre-existing condition in your family, or that just being sick can pauperize a family. So this is an emancipation. This is a right that frees people. And think of what that means to society and to the economy, that people can follow their aspirations and make a living doing what they love if they have the talent and not have that decision taken from them. And I don't know if you want any more on it.
Well, let's go back to the issues that are community-wide issues, but also LGBT community issues that were part of your original agenda in Congress. So you've done lots of work to increase funding for AIDS, HIV research and treatment. Also, it's the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell has been accomplished. Now,
so excited about that.
Now we come to President Obama's statement about his views on gay marriage. And let me ask the question in this way. Some people who very much support his announcement, or so much support his views, are puzzling over the announcement and the politics of it and the timing of it, feeling that the priority should be for him to get reelected, then come out with a position that is controversial still to some people. So what are your thoughts about the position he's taking and the timing of the announcement?
I think it's all great. I think it's all great. I think this. Why are we here? Let us ask ourselves that existential question. I get this on healthcare. Do you wish you didn't do healthcare so that maybe Democrats would have won the last election? I said, why did we come here? We came here to do a job, and besides, healthcare didn't have anything to do with that election. It was about a 9.5% unemployment. But take it to the president. The president's announcement, so beautifully spoken, so heartfelt and personal about how he came to his timing on this announcement, very important for the country. President of the United States supporting equality in another way, this marriage equality, but it's an expansion of what he has done as president. The first bill we gave him was Lilly Ledbetter that he signed to end discrimination in the workplace against women. The last bills he signed in the 2 years that we shared with him, we had 2 years before President Bush, but in those 2 years, Lilly Ledbetter at one bookend, the other bookend, ending the repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, both expanding opportunity for people, recognizing the dignity and worth of people and their contribution, and this marriage equality issue is about that. So I would say that if the president had not done that, you might make a political judgment, but that he did, he made a values judgment, and we're really very proud that the president of the United States speaking out for marriage equality. It's a beautiful thing.
Going back to the health care reform issue, there's a question from the audience that I just saw. What will you do if the Supreme Court throws out the health reform law? I know we don't want to imagine that, but what if?
You have to see what they do. I can't even imagine that they throw out the whole bill. You know, they might say that they decided on it. Let me just tell you this, because I think it's really important to understand the arena that we are in. The reason that we're before the Supreme Court is the principle of judicial review. Judicial review is a part of who we are as a country, that the courts can decide on the constitutionality of an act of Congress. It was established under Marbury versus Madison over 200 years ago. And we believe in that. And we wrote a bill. We always write a bill that honors the Constitution. But our colleagues on the other side of the aisle, not to be political, on the other side of the aisle, have not, and as recently as 04, 05, like that, were passing bills that said, these are the provisions of the bill, and another provision is that the court shall not have the right of judicial review. It's called court stripping. Strip the courts of the ability to review the constitutionality. Now, why would you do that? Maybe because you don't believe in judicial review and you don't think your bill measures up to constitutionality. But that was only half a dozen years ago they were doing that. They said Marbury versus Madison was wrongly decided, and even the freedom of the third, the independence of the judiciary, was not clearly defined in the Constitution. So these are some of the debates we're having about this subject. When along comes the health care bill, and all of a sudden we have these newfound advocates for judicial review who were 5 years before saying Marbury versus Madison was wrongly decided. That's on the public record. That's on the public record. So the very idea that they're taking it to the court, is interesting. I believe it's ironclad. I don't think they can take down the whole bill. More, not to get into it too technically, but it's a question of severability. If they think you can, if one hair on your head is bad, do they shave your whole head? Or do they say we can sever this and take this out and leave you intact? That's not a good analogy, but you get the point. but I still believe that if the court is making a constitutional decision, then it will be okay. You never know what the court will do. There are provisions in the health care bill that are active now that are studies by the Institute of Medicine on how to make it bend that cost curve further. Some projects that we will learn from. They are in the works. They will probably be finished. Some of them are coming to their own conclusion. And we will have the benefit of that. I can't imagine that my Republican friends will say now being a child means that you a pre-existing condition, you can be discriminated. I think that's the kind of discussion you will have. But do you know if a child has cancer, say 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, they have a pre-existing medical condition for life. This bill says no. That's going to be quite a fight. Many families have come to me and said, we're bankrupt. This child will never be able to get health care or affordable health insurance. Not health care, but affordable health insurance. And now they can. So if you're talking about kids on children, young people on their parents' policy, you're talking about non-discrimination against children who've had a pre-existing medical condition, talk about things like annual limits and lifetime limits, they're bye-byes. Do the Republicans want to bring those back? I mean, there are many really fabulous initiatives in the bill. It's about innovation. It's about prevention. It's about wellness. It's about the health of America, not just the health care of America, because, again, it's about wellness. And so there's so much to it that is not even close to anything constitutional. And the big target, of course, is the individual mandate, and we'll see. But I'm hopeful about the legislation, and I just don't see a situation where, judging by the Constitution, that they could take it down and take it down in its entirety. But it doesn't mean we're not always thinking about tomorrow, what to do.
One challenge for legislation and public policy is keeping up with science, since science is a constantly changing input into our public policy decisions. This is not a question. This is really just a comment about the importance of relooking at something like pre-existing conditions, because what might have been a pre-existing condition that couldn't be mitigated by medicine some years ago may no longer be so difficult given the change in the science and the treatment options and medication. So it's really important to continue looking at what is a pre-existing condition.
Well, if I may, on that subject, we talked about the health insurance industry. We talked about the anti-government ideologues who don't want any public role in healthcare. But we also have a fight about science in Congress. Can you imagine that? For a long time now, it was faith or science. Take your choice, but you can't have both. And we keep saying science is an answer to our prayers. God sent us this wisdom, and that doesn't go over too well with some of them. But there is an anti-science mentality that is really dangerous to the health of our people, the condition of our planet and our environment, that is detrimental to our competitiveness internationally in terms of innovation that springs from science, that springs from the classroom. And it is it's something that I think has to be part of a national debate. I think not this time, but the time before, you saw when they asked how many people believed in evolution among the presidential candidates on the Republican side, it was stunning to see how few hands went up. But the fact is that unless we embrace the science, all the things, it's a national security issue, how we defend our country, how we preserve God's precious gift to us, this planet, how we preserve that, how we advance health-wise, how we compete with jobs and the rest. We really have to win this fight as to what the role of science is, and it is certainly not contradictory to it being God-given. If I just may, because some of these questions, enlarge the issue for a little bit to, now I'm 25 years in the Congress, you go in, you're an advocate, you're boom, boom, you know, take the lead. Our issues here, we don't consider issues in San Francisco, we consider them values, ethics. This is, you know, to care for the God's creation is an act of worship. To ignore it is to dishonor the God who made us. You know, it's about putting it all in perspective. And so you have your point of view, and you try to prevail in the debate. And then 25 years go by, and you say, okay, how do we look at some of the challenges that we have had and decide as a country that some of these little battles really shouldn't be a fight? Should it be a question that a government has an imperative to be a job creator, to enable the private sector to do its job? Not create the jobs, public sector, some of it, yeah, but by and large to enable the private sector and the nonprofit sector to work its way. Essential to that is an imperative to educate the American people and not put up obstacles to their higher education and call them a snob if they want to go to college. The education of the American people is about our democracy, an informed electorate. It's about our competitiveness, a trained, skilled, knowledgeable workforce. And it's about the self-fulfillment of the individuals and how they raise their families to prepare for the next generation. This is what I think we're supposed to do. I don't think there's anything political or partisan about that. Do you? Create jobs, educate our people, and I think that healthcare is a part of that. We say we want to build ladders, we want to reignite the American dream, which is what our founders created. Reignite the American dream, being ladders of opportunity for people who want to work hard, play by the rules, take responsibility to succeed. And some of the rungs of those ladders of opportunity are about education and affordable health care and the rest of that. So why, you know, again, that should be something that I think is a given. And if that is so, that there's an imperative to create jobs and to do so, by the way, in a fiscally sound way, in a balanced way about how we create jobs, which create revenue, which help reduce the deficit, and how we have fairness and who, you know, in terms of revenue coming in. So this battle of the budget is a place where we have to bring some level of maturity to the issue as to how it serves the values of our country, not the difference of issues, but the fundamental role that the public and private sector play vis-a-vis each other, which is very important to recognize. The part of it is the role of women. Nothing, three times, isn't improved with the increased participation of leadership in women. Let me say it in the reverse. The leadership of women, the empowerment of women, whether it's in the military, whether it's in the financial or in business, whether it's in education, whether it's in politics, healthcare, you name it. Any of these endeavors are enhanced and improved by the increased participation of women in the leadership. So, and I'll end this question on this. So, therefore, the one thing, you know, we had the vote 91 years ago. We had women in the workforce during World War II. Then we had the higher education of women. And we had women in professions. But the one place we didn't build the bridge was child care, affordable, quality child care that would unleash the power of women and men. I'm not saying that women are the only caregivers of the children, but nonetheless, you know where the primary, where it usually falls. So this is something that we have to think of as a country. Are we going to benefit from the fullest participation of the leadership of women? And if we are, we have to make a decision about the quality of child care that we have in our, it is a missing link. It is a missing link, and we will have more economic growth. We will have better government and politics. We will have better national security. You name it. It'll all be better with more women in the leadership. Not the substitute for men, but the sharing of ideas, the interaction The interaction, very important.
So on this issue of access for women on child care, are you talking about legislation now? Does Congress have a role in this? What can be done?
I take your beautiful compliments that you paid when you were doing the introduction, but the fact is all of it is a consensus building. It's not as if we try to sell something to somebody. You all come together. This has to be a national debate where the American people decide whether this is a priority and how we deal with it in a way that rewards the work of people who are caregivers so that their quality is there for the children. And so it's all about a consensus building. And if the consent, we had the bill, before I was in Congress, but there was a bill that was going to be signed by President Nixon. It was passed by the Congress. President Nixon was ready to sign it, and then some folks who shall be nameless went to him and said, made this case that it was something he shouldn't sign. I won't go into it, but it wasn't a pleasant characterization of what child care would be. So it almost happened then. It should certainly happen as we go into the future.
For those listening and watching on radio, television, and the internet, this is the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're speaking with Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi on her 25th anniversary of serving in the U.S. Congress. So otherwise, on women's issues, I understand that you're going to do a hearing next week on the Paycheck Fairness Act. Tell us about that and what would it do?
Well, we talked earlier about Lilly Ledbetter, and Lilly Ledbetter was ending discrimination in the workplace, that a woman could sue if she thought she was being unfairly discriminated against in terms of pay. But the Paycheck Fairness Act takes us to a different place. It says that women performing the same duty should receive the same pay, and it's a step further down the road. It is legislation that is very long overdue in our country, and we're interested in hearing the testimony next week, because what we've been hearing in the press from some in the campaigns has been that there is no discrimination against women, that everybody, it's just a made-up thing. Mostly these are guys saying this, but and it's just a made-up thing, and that if women get paid more, men will get paid less. It's really simply not true. It's just rewarding work in a way that does not discriminate against women. And it's important. There are about four things. We had Lilly Ledbetter. We have Paycheck Fairness now coming up. We have the Violence Against Women Act. This is a very important piece of legislation. It was passed in the 90s. Joe Biden was chair of the Judiciary Committee. He was the big leader on this issue in the country, and many of us worked with him in the House of Representatives as well. So we reauthorized it. We had to fund it. I was part of that on the Appropriations Committee. And then now it's come up again, and there was a decision made by some in Congress to go backward. In other words, saying there should be, violence against women has saved lives. It's by 50% more situations remedied than before the bill. It's been quite impressive in terms of its results. But now they're saying we're going to have a Violence Against Women Act. So everybody, all you women, step forward if you think you're going to be protected. Not so fast if you're an immigrant, if you're a Native American, or if you are gay, lesbian, transgender, or bisexual. But that's just not right. We're sanctioning violence against some women, and trying to pass off that we're protecting all women in our country. The House, the Republicans, and the Democrats in the Senate voted for the bill 68-31. Every woman member, Democrats and Republicans alike, voted for it in the Senate. The House Democrats support the Senate bill. The House Republicans, if I just may have a moment of differentiation here, have put forth this ridiculous bill that takes us backward. So what is this? What is this? And then, of course, the issues that relate to respecting a woman's right to determine the size and timing of her family or issues that are in that spectrum. Here's what I think we should do. It's about campaigns. If we were to reduce the role of money in campaigns and increase the civility of the debate, many more women would be elected to public office. And these discussions would take another form. That's why I support public financing of campaigns. Let's just get rid of the whole money as a factor in campaigns. That's what we have to do.
Let's talk about higher education for a moment and funding for higher education. There's a lot of talk about the high cost of college tuition, the recent decision to terminate the Pell Grants program. So you and Javier Becerra had a meeting last week at Occidental College in Los Angeles,
my alma mater,
discussing the crisis with college presidents and students and the prospects for extending the federal student loan subsidy. Can you tell us more about the meeting? How can Congress, with your leadership, has it helped in the past with college aid to college students? How can it help in the future?
Well, Father Privet, would you like to take this question? Right now, we're in the battle of the budget. You noticed, right? And the whole idea is, how do we make cuts and reduce the deficit, which we all agree we have an imperative, moral imperative, create jobs, educate our people, and reduce the deficit. One of the ways that our Republican colleagues, I really don't like saying, well, one of the ways that our Republican colleagues have decided we can reduce the deficit is cutting people off of Pell Grants and reducing the amount of money that those left would receive for a Pell Grant. Another way is to make the interest on student loans go up to 6.8% from the 3.4% where it is now. We do not think that that is appropriate for a couple of reasons. First of all, the importance of educating the American people as a value. But second of all, it's important to know nothing, I'm using a term, nothing, reduces the deficit more than the education of the American people. Early childhood, K through 12, higher ed, lifetime learning. You want to reduce the deficit? Invest in education. You have to do it right, but invest in education. So these economies that I just described to you are false economies. They're not going to save any money. It's going to be an opportunity cost for what could come into our treasury with an educated workforce. And besides, we owe it to our kids. All these people who are against a government role, would they have nixed the GI Bill, which created the middle class in America? Would they have said no to the GI Bill, which gave affordability of home ownership to so many people? But nonetheless, right now, this is where they are on the bill, and we're having this fight. There are a couple different faces to it, as Father Privet would say. The cost of higher education is a challenge. So we have to find ways to reduce the cost so we're not just pouring more money, but how can we reduce the cost? But at the same time, we have to reduce the cost to individuals and their families. 5 years ago, under President Bush, I was a speaker, he was a president, we passed a bill that reduced the interest rate from 6.8 to 3.4. We could only get it for 5 years, and now the 5 years are up. And in the Republican budget bill, they take it to 6.8. Well, the president made this issue too hot to handle. He went all over the country, did his college tour, you noticed, and he talked about this issue. So now Republicans are saying, oh, we always intended to do that anyway. But we want to pay for it by taking money out of the prevention fund for women and children and men out of the health care bill. And we're saying, well, that's just ridiculous. That is ridiculous that you would pay for it by taking from the same middle-income people that we're trying to help over here. And by the way, these tax cuts that you want for the high end, are you paying for them? Oh, no, they don't have to be paid for. But interest on college loans, that has to be offset. So if it has to be offset, let's find a way. We say take it out of the tax cuts for the high end, tax subsidies for big oil. Big oil gets $38 billion over 10 years in tax subsidies. This is just the big five. In that course of that time, they'll make trillions of dollars. Trillions of dollars. But they need that $38 billion as an incentive to drill. They don't. We could use that money for educating the next generation of leaders and workers in our country. But they have said no. So this is the fight that we are in. We have to take it down. July 1 is D-Day. So we have a month for this to happen. And our great president, President Lincoln, said public sentiment is everything. The more the public knows about these choices that have to be made, the better average working everyday Americans are in terms of decisions that are made in Washington. But imagine we have a budget. You have to see it in the context of the whole budget. The Republicans have put forth a budget that severs the Medicare guarantee. And in the meantime, it'll take a few years to do that. In the meantime, seniors, for example, next year would pay $6,400 more to get fewer benefits while we give tax cuts to the wealthiest people making over $1 million a year of $400,000. You make $1 million, you're going to get a tax cut of $400,000 because they'll perpetuate the Bush tax cuts and they'll lower the rates. $400,000 if you make $1 million a year, $6,400 you pay in if you're a middle income senior. Just not right. I told you what it did to Pell Grants and interest on student loans and the rest of that. At the same time, $400,000 tax cut if you make $1 million a year. I don't think the American people think that's a statement of our national values, that we would have a budget that would have that much disparity in terms of fairness, economic fairness for our country. And, by the way, these tax cuts, they don't reduce the deficit. They increase it. They increase it. They don't create jobs, and they increase the deficit. The job creators are the great middle class who work, who consume, small businesses, the entrepreneurial spirit of America. That's where jobs are created. And those jobs, again, bring revenue to the till that in turn educates people, and the beat goes on. So this battle of the budget, we have a balanced thing. We said we know we have to make cuts. We've made over a trillion dollars in cuts in the past year over the Budget Act. We know we have to make some changes in terms of mandatory entitlement programs, but we want some revenue on the table. It cannot come out of the hide of working people in our country while, again, not one hair on the head of people making over $1 million a year. I think the only person that
So as we wend our way to the end of our discussion, unfortunately, a last area I'd like to focus on is the Congress as an institution. There are just so many questions and comments from the audience about why does it appear there can no longer be civil discussions between the right and the left? Why can't people work together instead of collaboration and compromise? Neither side wants to let the other have a victory because that might damage the prospects of one's own party or group. Let me ask the question in this way. What is lost when a gentleman like Republican Indiana Senator Dick Lugar, who's able to work across the aisle on both sides on crucial issues, is defeated, as he just was, by the Tea Party? Tell us about how can the Congress's method of working be improved? How can this extreme divide be bridged? And how do you do it?
Well, it doesn't have to be this way, and it hasn't always been. I was telling Gloria earlier that on February 20th, I had the privilege of speaking to President George Herbert Walker Bush. That would be President Bush 41, his President's Day program at Texas A&M, which is where the Bush Library, the Bush School of Public Policy and Government resides. It was lovely. It was gracious, as he and Mrs. Bush always are. And the subject of my presentation on President's Day with President Bush was about civility and the need for us to return it to the political and the governmental arena. Absolutely essential. Not even a question. But to poison the well of debate is a victory for big money. Because if you have big money, you can suffocate the system with your views. You can suppress the vote, which is what's happening in elections. You suffocate the airwaves. You suppress the vote. You poison the debate, and you get questions like this. Why can't you all get something done and work together? With all due respect to your question, it's a legitimate question that comes up. So if people throw up their hands and say a pox on both your houses, you have an equivalence that's just not fair for people who really do want civility, and they exist on both sides of the aisle. So when President Bush was president, believe me, we had our differences of opinion, but we had respect for each other's views. And that's why he invited me to come there. I was so honored by the invitation to come. Texas A&M is supposed to be the most conservative campus in Texas. They were lovely. And Mrs. Bush said, I feel sad for you. You only have 8 protesters, and they're very polite. So in any case, even when President Bush, 43, was president, we worked together. You know, we passed the biggest energy bill in the history of our country working and compromising with President Bush. We passed a stimulus package that he wanted. I wanted infrastructure. He wanted tax of something or other. And we worked it out so that it helped poor people, too. Poor people and middle-income people as well as high-end. So we came to a compromise. And we rescued the country with the TARP bill, which was the president's problem, the president's proposal, while President Bush was still president, and the Democrats came to the rescue because it was the right thing to do for our country. So it doesn't have to be this way. But really, it's important to note this, I think. You tell me. People are saying that Republicans are obstructionist. They don't want President Obama to succeed. And that's true. But they're obstructionist with conviction. They don't believe in a public role. So it's easy for them to obstruct. We have a bill that's going to create jobs. I don't believe in a public role, so I'm against that. So it's not the thought that if they were there, they would use the public arena to the advantage of working people in our country. They don't believe in the public role. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's not just obstructionism for the sake of a political agenda that they want the president not to succeed so he can't win in the election, and they can. It's obstructionism with the, bless their hearts, they do what they believe and they don't believe in government. So that's really what the challenge is, to get the people who do, and you mentioned Senator Lugar, want to fight out conservative. That's a legitimate place to be. So when President Bush Sr. was president, we were sort of on this spectrum, right to left, fight it out, where do we end up for a solution for the American people? This breed of person who is there now has cut that, and we're on two different paths. We're in, is there a public role? There isn't. And if you don't believe in a public role, then you will. If you understand that, you understand why almost every day we're voting in Congress against. They vote for, we vote against. They want to stop the implementation of regulations regarding clean air, clean water, food safety, public education, public housing, public transportation, public health, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. They don't believe in it. And bless their hearts, they act upon their beliefs. And that is why you can't find common ground on these issues and on the legislation, because it's two different paths. I believe that if we take it to the higher ground that we talked about earlier, creation of jobs, education, of our people, the health and economic security for our seniors, all this done in a fiscally sound way as we defend our country and keep it healthy. Let's keep it on a higher ground of values and not issues in legislation. Then we can accomplish much more for the American people. They expect and deserve better. They have to, public sentiment is everything. The public has to be engaged in all of this. And if there are any Republicans who happen to be in the room, take back your party. We need a strong, grand, old Republican party for our country. This is not the grand old party that we know. And it's a different place.
As someone whose great-grandfather joined the Republican Party in 1864, I completely agree with you. One last question. Taking back the House. How likely, what could be done if it was taken back? And briefly, unfortunately, we're just about out of time.
Briefly. If it were today, I think it's 50-50 that we would take back the House. We're in a drive for 25. It's easy to remember. It's my 25th year, shamelessly exploiting my 25th anniversary in Congress. A drive for 25 in order to win back the House. California will be essential to our success, and we're very proud of the diversity that California also brings to the Congress in addition to numbers and intellect. We think that it isn't today. The influence of big, unidentified, special interest money, we have to see how that weighs in. But we're prepared to make the fight. And when we do, when we win, one of the things that we would do, you asked that, is to reform the political system, get rid of money in politics. You and the people at Texas A&M agree. That is something we must do. Return civility, reduce the role of money, return to what our founders envisioned of a democracy, the voice of, and vote of the many versus the checkbooks of a few for a plutocracy. So in any case, it's about this great country as we just come out of, as we are just coming out of Memorial Weekend. We honor those who made the supreme sacrifice for our country, our men and women in uniform. We owe them a future worthy of their sacrifice. We owe our founders faithfulness to their vision. We owe our children everything we can do to honor their aspirations for a better future for them and for our great country. Thank you, Commonwealth Club, for the opportunity to spend time with you today.
Thank you, Nancy Pelosi. Congratulations from all of us on the silver anniversary of your service in Congress. Thank you for your dedicated work for all of us, from the people and your friends in San Francisco. Thank you all for joining us. If you could stay seated a moment while Leader Pelosi leaves, that would be terrific.
You.